Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does a city hide from itself, and what happens when we ignore the keep-out signs and decide for ourselves what should be off-limits? Moses Gates is an urban planner, visiting assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute, and a licensed New York City tour guide whose official tours shared history and culture with visitors from the relative comfort of a double-decker bus. But his personal explorations of places like New York, Paris, Rome, Moscow, and Rio de Janeiro have been well off the beaten path, underground in abandoned railway lines, catacombs, and sewers, and well above it at the summits of bridges, the bell towers of cathedrals, and the observation decks of buildings no longer open to the public. He takes readers on some of these adventures in his new book, Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. Moses, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you visited the World Trade Center's observation deck, official observation deck, just a few weeks before 9/11. Can you talk about how those attacks inspired you to go to the places you were curious about whether or not you were officially allowed?
So what happened is I lived in New York that summer, and we had a friend who worked in the basement of the World Trade Center at the Gap, I'm pretty sure. And just kind of on a whim, I went up to the top of the World Trade Center, and they let us on the roof. If it was a nice day, they'd let you on the roof, and it was the most amazing place I'd ever been. It was $10. It was the best $10 I ever spent. And I remember thinking, wow, I live here, and it's so huge, and I have so much time to discover it all. And then I think it was maybe a month and a half later or something like that, you had the World Trade Center attacks, and what that really taught me, and everybody learns this at some point in time, that there's a limited time for everything, that you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you don't know what's going to be here tomorrow. So I had always loved cities and big complicated cities, but that was what really kind of inspired me to see things. That's what really kind of inspired me to do it quickly and gave me that motivation to really see the things I wanted to see. And it also gave me a great love for observation decks.
And the first time you went anywhere that you weren't specifically allowed to go, the biggest surprise was that there was nobody there to stop you.
Right. So the story I talk about in the book, I believe, is the first time I went on the subway tracks,
right,
which was a nondescript station and nondescript tracks. But the first place I ever went that was off the beaten path in New York City was the old High Line. I don't know if the viewers or the listeners in Dallas kind of know about the High Line, but it's this old abandoned rail line that runs down a really populous neighborhood on the west side of New York City. And it was just an abandoned little ecosystem above the streets. It was really cool. It had its own, it had trees and shrubbery, and it was its own little world. And I was always curious about it. And then one day I just followed the rail line to the end of the line, and there was a ramp that led down into the parking lot. So I went in the parking lot and went up the ramp, and it was as easy as that. And it's the kind of thing where online and in articles, they had presented it as this off-limits, mysterious place, and it really wasn't. It was really just as easy as going to the end and walking right on it. And that's kind of what really taught me that a lot of times these off-limits barriers are just mostly in our own head. They're not anything physical. Like, there was no fence to climb. There was no wall to get over. It was just zoom, up and on. And since then, the High Line, I think a lot of it is because so many people found it so intriguing and wanted to go on it. The High Line got a lot of both government and private attention and investment, and is now open to the public as a landscaped promenade.
So I have to tell you, I think part of the reason that I love this book is that I would never do any of these things. I am very much a rule follower, and yet there was this sort of ability to sort of look on in a voyeuristic way. But it did occur to me reading this, how strange it is in a way that we human beings mostly follow the rules, even when there's nobody to stop us.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the kind of thing where it's always good to take a step back and think if you're doing something because it's the right thing to do, or if you're doing something just because that's what somebody said and you never really thought about it. And that's true for traveling, and it's true for everything. So, what I hope people get from the book is that you know, our lives are our own, and our decisions of what to do should be informed decisions and should be about us thinking about them. And is this something that's the right thing to do, or is it not something that's the right thing to do, and making those decisions for ourselves?
So you have this great love, Moses, of history. And one of the things that you have discovered is that actually being in these places is really a great way to kind of enhance your understanding of what you might have read about in guidebooks.
Oh, absolutely. So there are so many places I've gone that because they're off limits, the history is kind of stuck around.
Mm-hmm.
So many times in cities, especially in cities, there's development pressure and things get torn down and redeveloped, and the history that's preserved is preserved in a mitigated way. It's put in a museum, it's put behind glass, it's put in, it's commodified and preserved in a way that's not, you just stumble across it. So when you go into the catacombs of Paris, the most amazing thing down there is you see these signs that were carved 200 years ago. And so in the French Revolution in 1789, that's where the metric system comes from. They decided to redo all of the measurements in a logical way. So they, and some of those stuck, kilometers stuck, kilograms stuck. Some of those kind of measurements stuck. Some of the things didn't. The French Revolution redid the entire calendar to be more logical. They did, I am not sure if I've got this right, but they did, I think, 10 months of 35 days and then a 15-day end-of-the-year period or something like that, something where it was really uniform. And they renamed all the months, and then they started the calendar over. And year one was the year of the French Revolution. And when you go down in the catacombs, the engineers over the years have inspected the various quarries and the various tunnels, and then they'll carve on the wall when it was inspected and who the engineer was. And, you know, sometimes you'll find 1782, and sometimes you'll find 1812, and then sometimes you'll find 12R, because they're using, that's the 12th year of the revolutionary calendar, the Republican calendar. You don't find that anywhere above ground. Above ground, it's all been changed to the correct dates now. You only find that underground where there's not that everyday city. And so running into things like that, and it happens quite a bit when you're doing this stuff, is just an absolutely amazing experience.
How did it happen that Parisians had to start warehousing their dead sort of en masse in the catacombs to begin with?
So it's really interesting. So Paris was one of the first modern metropolises of the Western world. And you have in especially the 1700s in Paris, also in London, an explosion of population. So Paris originally was pretty small. It started on the Ile de la Cite in the middle of the Seine, and then kind of gradually expanded out. And we have all these problems, all these city problems that we don't think about today. We don't think about, wow, I turn on the tap and water comes out. And we don't think about, oh, I flush the toilet and it all just disappears. But these are problems that were solved out of necessity because you need fresh water. If you're in a city, you need to not have cesspools in your basement if you're in a city. And one of those problems was the main cemetery of Paris was right next to its main market. And so I want you to imagine being an average Parisian in the mid-1700s and going to buy your daily bread, and next to the market where you're buying your daily bread, they're burying 20 dead bodies. And in, you know, a small area, and in order to bury them, they would dig up the graves and throw some more people in the graves. And, you know, it was not a very good situation.
Doesn't make you hungry, that's for sure.
Right. So they decided, well, we have to have a solution to this. Now, Paris is in a region with a lot of good limestone and gypsum.
Mm-hmm.
So they would quarry it to build the buildings of Paris. The Louvre, the Notre Dame, all of this is from stone that's not that far outside what was then the central city. Paris expands. They start to build over all these old quarries. It's a problem. You know, you build a house, you're over an improperly stabilized old limestone quarry, the house collapses into the ground. It's not a good situation. So in the late 1700s, this is before the Revolution, under the kings of France, they formed an agency called the Inspection Générale des Carrières. My French accent is horrible. I apologize. And what they did was they went around tunneling underneath the city to find all these old abandoned limestone quarries and stabilize them so that they could develop over the tops of they could develop in the roads and over the top of the quarries, and the houses wouldn't fall in the ground. Mm-hmm. So you have these two problems, the dead bodies and the limestone quarries, and they decided to combine them. And what they did was they said, okay, we can't have a bunch of dead bodies near our main market in the middle of the city. So they dug them all up, along with a couple of other cemeteries, treated them with lime, because these bodies are gross, as you might imagine, to stop the putrefaction process, and then put them down in the old limestone quarries. And there's millions of remains in the quarries. There's about 6 million human remains, skeletons, in the old limestone quarries of Paris, and you can actually go see them on a tour. It'll cost you €8. But if you're ever in Paris, take the catacombs tour. It is really cool and really creepy.
So what do you see when you explore on your own and you don't take that €8 tour?
So the €8 tour is wonderful, and it will lead you through a lot of the catacombs that have those remains in them. It'll be, I think it's a little under a mile, and it's a great way to see a little hidden part of Paris. The other thing you can do is schlep down some abandoned train tracks, crawl through a hole in the ground, and have 170 miles of the same abandoned, stabilized limestone quarries to just kind of wander around in. I've spent days down in the catacombs. We camp down there. It's really, really fun. And you'll also run into other ossuaries, which is what they call the underground graveyards, essentially. Mm-hmm. And these ossuaries are not for tourists and therefore don't have the nice stacked, stable bones that you find on the tourist part of the catacombs. Instead, they're just kind of scattered around all throughout these little rooms. But there's so much other things to see in the catacombs. There's two World War II bunkers, one that the Free French forces used and one that the German Nazi forces used, both of them in the catacombs. And I think there's a couple of other World War II bunkers as well. There's amazing art. There's all sorts of rooms. There's all sorts of stuff. It's this incredible shadow world underneath Paris.
That makes me think about my other fantasy of like spending the night alone in Carlsbad Caverns.
Mm.
And of course, I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm wondering if you don't get spooked by noises you hear and wondering who else might be down there with you and might sort of come upon you when you're in your sleep.
So there actually are a lot of people down in the catacombs. There's a whole culture in Paris, subculture I should say, called cataphiles, who like going in the catacombs. And they do a lot of things. They'll make art. They'll work on opening up different sections of the catacombs. They'll throw parties. There's a lot of parties. So there's always a bunch of people down there. And every time I've been in the catacombs, I've run across people. Just, you know, hanging out or exploring. There's one section of the catacombs where most people kind of go to hang out, and you'll encounter less people in less out-of-the-way places. But the last time I was there, we were camping out. We were sleeping in this room called the Cabinet Mineralogique, and we were just hanging out there asleep, and this woman walking alone by herself just stumbled in on us and, you know, was like, bonjour, and we were like, bonjour. You know, it's Paris. It's folks are pretty friendly.
My guest is Moses Gates. He's an urban planner, licensed New York City tour guide, and visiting assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute. He's got a new memoir out called Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with urban planner Moses Gates, whose new book is called Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Moses, you mentioned in the last segment that one of the great structures built with some of that excavated limestone is the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And I love you opened the book with a story of your explorations there after hours with a sort of new friend guide who essentially casually said, yeah, there's this church that I've been wanting to explore. Do you want to come with me?
Yeah, so this was our second or third time in Paris, and we knew some cataphiles, we knew some people, and one of our friends introduced us to another friend, and she said, oh, Nico likes to climb, you should meet Nico. So we're like, okay, we'll meet Nico. So we meet Nico at a bar. Nico is dressed, he has like an Argyle sweater, and I think he was wearing dress shoes. You know, he looks very Parisian.
Right.
So we're like, okay, well, you know, we'll hang out with this guy, whatever, and we drink a glass of wine and whatnot. And, you know, then we go out and head out and hit the town, and we go to this underground canal that I really like that runs right underneath where the Bastille used to be and where the Colonnade Juliette is now, if you know Paris. And we pop a manhole, and Paris's manholes weigh like 200 pounds. So I was there trying to get this manhole open, and I couldn't do it, and it was the most embarrassing thing of my life. Because I'm with my friend Steve, I'm with this guy Nico. These are like, you know, men of action, and I'm sitting there, you know, hanging out underneath the manhole, not able to open it. So finally we get the manhole open, and I will say since then my manhole popping technique has improved, and I can open Paris manholes. I would just like to make that clear.
Let me stop you for 1 second, because you open a manhole and basically you pop up like a gopher, like on a city street somewhere.
Yes. Paris is the most amazing place in the world. We one time popped out of a manhole on a busy street at about 1 in the afternoon, just like 5 or 6 of us. And it was super fun because we just come out onto the sidewalk, and it's like Parisian sidewalk life. And I will just never forget, there was this old lady who just stopped and stared with her mouth open as like these 5 or 6 filthy people just came out of a hole in the ground. It was really fun. But Paris is the kind of place that, you know, people are pretty okay with you doing whatever you want to do. You know, maybe they'll be amused by it, but nobody's going to stress out a whole lot. So we pop out of the hole in the ground, and I'm already feeling kind of embarrassed because I can't get the manhole open. So I'm obviously going to be like, yeah, okay, whatever. Let's do everything. So Nico is like, yeah, there's this church that I think we can climb. And I'm like, okay, let's go to the church. So we walk along, and we cross the Seine, and I'm like, is he talking about the Notre Dame? And we get there, and we get to the Notre Dame, and he's like, okay, so I came here a little while ago, and there's some, like, scaffolding around. So it was completely the silliest thing in the world. We just found these two pieces of scaffolding and fit them together and started climbing, making an awful racket, being not subtle at all. And we made it up to about the third tier. The Notre Dame kind of has terraces, and where we scooted up a flying buttress onto one of the terraces, and then we were kind of stuck. And I was like, okay, we're cool. This was fun. Let's get out of here. And then we notice a door, and, you know, Steve is like trying to climb a drain pipe, and Nico is, you know, futzing with the door. And we look at the door, and this is, and I don't mind saying this because I did get arrested for this. We just noticed the whole lock set was just screwed onto the door. And Nico was like, I have a leather man, and just unscrewed it. And that's how we got in the Notre Dame. So we kind of walked up the stairs, headed out on the roof. I'm insanely nervous. So I'm, of course, like, hey, this is great. Let's hang out here. And then Steve and Nico start to climb up the roof. So I, because I am feeling inadequate, follow them. And we get into the spire, which is not the part they let tourists on. They let tourists on one of the two front towers. So if you're ever at the Notre Dame, you'll go up the Notre Dame, you'll be on one of the two front towers, and you'll look and you'll see this really tall, narrow spire, and that's where we were. And so we're in there, and for whatever stupid reason, I decided I had to ring the bell. And so I rang the bell, and then about 5 minutes after that, we heard bonsoir, and the police came up and took us away.
And they took you away, but it doesn't sound like you got in a whole lot of trouble.
Paris is the kind of place where if you don't damage anything, it's not going to be a huge deal. Paris, there's a lot of people who like to climb things and go in the catacombs, and it's just kind of an understood thing in Paris that people like to explore the city. And I think that's so great that in Paris there's that culture of, oh, we're a really cool city. People like to explore it. People like to see it. And that's a perfectly natural thing. It might not always be smiled upon, but it's viewed as not weird. It's viewed as like, oh, of course you want to climb the Notre Dame. The Notre Dame is awesome. Who wouldn't? Of course you want to go explore the catacombs. The catacombs are so cool because Paris is so cool, it makes perfect sense. That's kind of the attitude in Paris. So as long as you don't break anything, it's not going to be a huge deal to get caught like climbing the Notre Dame. So we got caught. They took us to the police station. They didn't even handcuff us. We sat there for a few hours. They made us take a breathalyzer test, which, you know, we failed miserably.
I guess you'd have to, am I right? Do you sort of have to be under the influence to think this is a good idea?
No, actually you don't. You know, I'm not going to say that I have never had an idea under the influence that is, you know, a nutty idea. But really, everything I've done because I've wanted to do. And occasionally you take a shortcut to make yourself a little less nervous, which I, you know, is not something I encourage people to do, but I cannot in good conscience decry it as I've done it myself. But I do it less and less. You know, it's a shortcut. It's just to make yourself less nervous. It's not to actually get any new ideas. I've never done anything that I only did because, you know, I had a couple drinks in me. Mm-hmm. Everything I've done is because I've wanted to do it.
Now, do most urban explorers, Moses, or people who, I guess, you know, anybody can sort of take on this title, but do most people have rules for themselves about being really careful not to cause any damage, not to leave any trash behind, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, people try to be respectful. This is a hobby where everybody involved in this hobby is involved because they make decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the kind of people who are going to see a no trespassing sign and say, actually, is that something that I personally think is a good idea or don't? So it's the kind of thing where I have my opinions, other people have their opinions. You know, everybody has a different opinion on how much is appropriate to kind of influence the places you are or not. And I've just learned that, you know, it doesn't really matter because, you know, you're telling a whole bunch of people who don't follow rules how to follow rules. It's just kind of paradoxical and is not going to work. So I generally don't stress out a whole lot worrying about what other people do because I just know it's not anything that I can, you know, have any influence over. That being said, I would say the vast majority of urban explorers, in fact, I would say all urban explorers, respect their environment and respect the city. And the exploration for cities comes out of a place of love and comes out of a place of curiosity and appreciation and things like that. And as such, you know, they behave as you would behave to a place that you have appreciation for.
What's it like in a place like Rome where the ancient relics are vastly older than even those you can find in Paris?
Oh, man, it's so crazy in Rome. So first of all, in Rome, there's all sorts of underground stuff that isn't discovered. Hmm. And the reason it's not discovered is because if you discover an ancient Roman ruin underground, now you're responsible for it. And being responsible for it costs money. So a lot of times you'll have a church, and the church will know that probably if they knock down a wall, they'll find some ancient catacombs or something. And they're not going to knock down the wall because they don't want to be responsible for making sure that it's stable and keeping it up and everything like that. So as a result, there's all these crazy hidden nooks underneath Rome, just kind of out there, undiscovered. And we were schlepping around the sewers. We were trying to look for the Cloaca Maxima, which is the oldest sewer in Rome. And we just found an outfall, went in the sewers, and we're exploring them, just walking along, and there was a little offshoot. And we went in the little offshoot, and it was this old room that with Roman-era bricks, like the same kind of bricks that you find above ground in the ruins. Hmm. And it was cool, and we didn't really think much of it. And then later on, the Rome Underground Society found the pictures on the Internet and contacted Steve and I and said, hey, we don't know about this. And I talked to them, and they said, you know, we don't know about it. The archaeologists don't know about it. The sewer workers knew it was there, but they didn't really know what it was. And I just thought it was so astounding that I, as an American, could fly into Rome for the first time and just find some ancient Roman ruins just poking around. It's a crazy city.
All of these explorations are things that you're sort of traveling at your own risk in a way that going to places that are publicly allowed are not, the public places are protected and they're set up to protect you. Can you talk about your relationship to fear and to risk? And it doesn't sound like you go into any of these things without thinking about how to keep yourself safe.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing is that the riskier something is, the sharper I generally am when I do it. So every time I've gotten hurt or caught has always been because I've gotten too comfortable. It's because it's somewhere I'd been before or somewhere I didn't think was a big deal, and it's always just been the result of not paying attention. So that's really the lesson I've learned, is to always pay attention, always stay alert, never get comfortable, never think that you're in part of the everyday environment. And that's the biggest thing. I'm scared all the time. Every single story in this book, I'm scared. I don't know if I convey that, but I definitely am. And there's things that everybody is both curious about and fearful of. And it's different for everybody. Everybody has different things like that. And I think a lot of times we kind of let our fear trump our curiosity, and the book is really about trying to make your curiosity trump your fear and going and expanding your comfort zone and going and seeing the things you want to see and do the things you want to do that you might be scared of. It doesn't mean you should do anything you're terrified of that's a stupid idea, but it does mean that you should, instead of just automatically being, oh, that's uncomfortable or scary, I'm not going to do it, you should take a step back and think of it a little more deeply and say, is this one of those times where I should let my curiosity take lead instead of let my fear take lead? And it can be for many, many different things. One of my favorite writers is a guy named Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes for The Atlantic. And right now he's writing about going to Paris for the first time. And, you know, he's learning French, and I'm not sure, but I think it's his first time in Europe. And he's talking about that fear of the unknown and a new environment and new people and a new language. And it's that, but he's letting his curiosity trump his fear. And it's the exact same feeling that I felt in this book doing all of these adventures, even though it's for a completely different thing.
Do you have to understand the sort of standard above ground culture of a city before you can make sense of what you find that's been hidden away?
I think no. I think the two go together, because when I went to Paris, I had gone to Paris just on a sightseeing trip for, I think I was there maybe 3 days, and I kind of saw, you know, the things, the regular tourist things to see. The second time I went, which is the trip in this book, you know, we spent the majority of our time underground. We spent an amazing amount of time in the catacombs. We saw as much as we could see. And I learned the underground of Paris the same time I learned the above ground. Mm. You know, I also, you know, I went to the Louvre when I was there, kind of thing. And the two really went together for me. So I would say that you can learn a city from the outside in, you can learn it from the inside out, you can learn the underneath first, you can learn the above ground first. But for me, I want to learn everything. And I think that's kind of the lesson, that everything in a city is important if it's hidden away or, you know, if it's in plain sight.
How do you decide who, when you're traveling with someone else, exploring with someone else, who the ideal companions are for particular trips?
So I always like to be the stupidest person in the group, and that is just me. I always like to go with people who are better at this than I am, and that's because I know my limits, and I know what I can do, and I know, you know, when I am doing something that's too far out of my comfort zone or something stupid, so I can be responsible for myself. I hate being responsible for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody is, like, less experienced than I am, it's always hard for me because I always feel responsible for them, and then it's no fun for them, and it's no fun for me. So I personally always love to go with, like I love going with Steve because Steve's way better at this stuff than I am. Or I like going with, you know, a bunch of crazy Australians because they're also way better at this stuff than I am. But it's a luxury to always be, you know, the least capable person in the group. The other thing is, a lot of times there's a tension, and the tension is you're scared and you want to do something, and you're trying to get up the motivation to go take that final step, but also you don't want to be too stupid. You know, there's a lot of times when, you know, something seems like a bad idea, and it actually is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always that tension of trying to be adventuresome, but also not too stupid. And so when I went places with Steve in this book, where I went a lot of places with him, it really worked because Steve is always the one to be more adventuresome and be like, of course let's hop this fence. Like, of course let's do this. Of course it's a good idea. And I'm always the one to be like, I don't know, maybe it's not so great. And so that tension really worked to keep us on the right track of adventuresome, but still not too dumb. There's other times with other people where I'm the adventuresome one and they're the cautious one. It's all just how you play off of each other. And it's all just a personal thing. There's plenty of people I like who I don't feel comfortable exploring with, and some people I feel comfortable exploring with that, you know, outside of that I don't always get along with.
My guest is urban planner Moses Gates, who is a visiting assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute. He's also the author of a new book called Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with urban explorer Moses Gates, author of the new book Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So I really enjoyed reading this book. My favorite part was reading about bridge climbing. As a kid growing up in Long Island, we would travel across the George Washington Bridge to visit my aunt and uncle in New Jersey. And mm-hmm. I used to enjoy sort of imagining climbing to the top of the cables of those bridges as we would be going along, never imagining that anybody would ever have the nerve to actually do that.
A lot of people do. So people have been climbing the bridges of New York since they've been built. For the book, I did a lot of research in the old New York Times archives, and if you peruse the Times from the late 1800s or early 1900s, there's all sorts of funny stories about people climbing up the Brooklyn Bridge. There was one where I think it was a Swedish sailor climbed up and then stood on his head and waved his legs. And then the last sentence of the article is, "Today, Hingrend will be examined as to his sanity." So it's something that, you know, you are not alone in that attraction to the bridges in New York and the bridges of everywhere. It's something people have been doing for a long time. A friend of mine, John Law, has climbed probably every significant bridge in the United States, I would say. during the 1970s, 1980s, the Golden Gate, the Brooklyn, he even got up the Verrazano a long time ago. So it's something that is definitely an attraction. And in Sydney, and also in Auckland, and also in Brisbane, which are in New Zealand and Australia, but Sydney is the most famous, they finally figured out that people like bridges and like to climb bridges, and they made a bridge climb as a tourist thing. Mm-hmm. So in Sydney, you can actually go and climb up the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which is an arch bridge. If you live in New York, or you don't live in New York, your readers are in Dallas, but it's an arch bridge, which is a one single arch that goes across a river. And it's the most famous landmark in Australia and probably the most famous bridge in the Southern Hemisphere. And you can go and you can climb it. It costs you, I think, about $100 or so. But anybody can do it. And I think it's the greatest thing in the world. And I really wish they had more bridge climbs in really anywhere.
I suppose it's a view that is the opposite of what you'd see from the city looking at the bridge, and something that even with the official tours, not that many people ever get.
No, so it's a really great view for a couple of reasons. So if you're on a standard observation deck in the middle of the city, you get one kind of separation. You get the vertical separation. You see the city below you. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you can have a horizontal separation. Like here in New York, if you're in Brooklyn or Queens, you look across a river and you see the city that way. Being on a bridge, you get both kinds of separation. So you have that vertical separation and that horizontal separation. And it's just so incredible because you never get that view anyway else. And the other part of it is you have so much space to yourself. You are on top of a bridge over a water. You don't have any buildings, any person, anything around you for hundreds, if not thousands of feet. You know, you're this little speck in this great, huge space, but yet you're still part of the city. You're still attached to it. You can still see it. The electricity is still there. So that dichotomy, that kind of removal and attachment, and those two kinds of removals from the city, the vertical and the horizontal, combined for this just amazing experience.
How do you manage your fear of heights when you do a climb like that?
I actually don't have a fear of heights. I've always been good with heights. Not in the physical book, but in the e-book, my mother has commentary about when I was, I think, less than a year old, finding me on top of the refrigerator.
But other people, do you climb with people who are afraid of heights? I suppose I should have said, how does one manage one's fear of heights?
So I think one manages one's fear of heights the way one manages any fear, which is you either resolve to get past it and you do it, or you don't. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah.
I'm fearful of a lot of stuff. I was fearful of the majority of things I did that are written in the book, but, you know, you put mind over matter and you do it. And that's the only thing I can tell you.
So as you mentioned earlier, you can get pretty dirty doing some of these explorations. Is there like a certain set of clothing that you tend to go to every time, or do you just wear what you have on?
So I have explored in everything from a suit to my underwear, quite honestly. But generally speaking, I will wear, jeans and a t-shirt and a jacket. I don't mind getting dirty. I've ruined 3 leather jackets doing this stuff. Every time I've bought a nice leather jacket, I've been like, this will be my day jacket that I'm going to keep clean and not rip up, and not my exploring jacket. And then inevitably I find myself in a tunnel with it. And, I'm like, oh, darn it. So I'm on my 3rd one and it's already looking pretty tattered.
What do you take with you? I know you have, often you have a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a flashlight.
Usually. I've been known to forget a flashlight a time or two.
So what would you have with you?
So I sometimes will carry a little pocket camera, but I'm not a photographer. There's so many great urban exploration photographers out there that I don't really feel the need to add my voice to it. If you're into photos of this stuff, you should definitely check out undercity.org, which is Steve's website, Steve Duncan, who's in the book. You can also check out, I'm going to plug my website quickly, I'm sorry, mosesgates.com, under links, I have links to a bunch of different urban exploration websites from people in the book and also other great ones. And, you know, there's a lot of photography out there. So because of that, I've never really felt the need to take photos myself. So I will sometimes take a camera, sometimes not. I will usually remember a flashlight, but there's been a few times when I've been like, oh, darn it, I totally forgot a flashlight. And sometimes you just fumble around, or sometimes someone else has a flashlight, but it usually works itself out. But I would say it's the biggest thing you need to take is just a healthy sense of curiosity. That's really it. There's no gear checklist or anything like that. Clothes you don't mind getting dirty, a passport, and a healthy sense of curiosity, and you're pretty much good to go.
If you will be exploring in the sewers, you want to know what the weather's going to be like.
Yes, absolutely. So, first of all, sewers are different from drains. This is a common non-urban explorer thing to mix up. So sewers are for human waste, for poop. And storm drains are for rain, for water runoff. And storm drains are usually much larger than sewers. In many cities, the two are combined. The sewers and the storm drains are the same tunnels. But in many cities, they're separate, and there'll be tunnels only for storm drains and then separate smaller tunnels for sewers. And if you are in a storm drain when it rains, you are pretty well screwed. It is not a good place to be, and as such, you should always check the weather, and you should also always make sure you have a way out. If you're in a drain, one of the most important things is to keep track of how you get out, if you're going to get out. There's been only one time I've been in a drain and been scared that that it was going to rain and we would be in a tight spot, and this was actually in Russia. We had gone in a drain, which was an underground river that was turned into a drain, the Neglinka River, which is where the original city of Moscow was formed, at the junction of the Moscow River and the Neglinka River. So we walked through it. We basically walk right under Red Square, and we get to the end, and there's a gate at the end, and we look out onto the Moscow River, and it's kind of sprinkling a little bit, which is very bad.
Mm-hmm.
So we run back upstream, and we've got a little while to the next manhole. Manholes aren't as close together as they are in a lot of drains in the United States. We get to the manhole. The guy we're with, a local, says, okay, this is the worst way to get out of a drain. We are going to come. We exited right by the Bolshoi Theater. I think it was the Bolshoi Theater, but a theater that's basically right across from Red Square. And so we pop the manhole. Nobody, thank goodness, is around. Close it up. Sit down by this huge statue of Karl Marx, getting happy with ourselves, are like, woohoo, you know, dressed in, you know, people are wearing hip waders and have backpacks and tripods and are generally looking like, why are you hanging out, you know, dressed like this in downtown Moscow? So after a few minutes, we got rolled up on by three Russian police with machine guns, which was the scariest moment of my entire life.
Mm.
But it ended up okay.
Has the ability to do this changed since we've become much more sensitive to potential terrorist activity?
So, I mean, I really don't think those two things are related. It's strange to talk about, but, like, you know, people who want to hurt us want to do it where there's people.
Yeah.
And, you know, those people are not found in storm drains. And they're not found in abandoned buildings, and they're not found in most of these places. And I am really an opponent of this idea that, like, security is achieved through less knowledge. I think that the best way to secure our cities is to make people more knowledgeable about our cities. I think that's the best way for people personally to be safe. And I think that the more knowledge we can put out there about our cities and the more regular people know about them, I think the better and safer we are, and that will be. And the idea that you can put knowledge back in a box in 2013 in the age of the Internet is a silly idea. And I think that, you know, the attempt to put the idea that, oh, you know, we're going to not have pictures of places or we're not going to have knowledge about our infrastructure, I think is just not something that I think the cart has left the horse has left the barn. I just think it's something that the correct way to go is to get people more knowledgeable about their city, and I think that's the best way to stay safe on an individual and a collective level.
It is pretty striking that people can go their entire lives living in a particular city without ever visiting the kinds of places that you describe in this book. What do you think they're missing out on?
Well, I think it depends on who they are. So we're all curious about different things. I happen to be curious about cities, and so I like going in tunnels and things like that. Not everybody is curious about tunnels. I understand if somebody says, why do I want to go down that hole in the ground, whatever. You know, somebody might be curious about traveling to different places, or they might be curious about eating different foods. They might be curious about a bunch of stuff. And so the message of the book is really follow your curiosity, and when your curiosity conflicts with your fear, you know, I'm not always saying plunge full steam ahead without, you know, with blinders on, but I'm saying, you know, think about it and think, is this a time when life will be better if you let your curiosity trump your fear? And that can be about many, many different things. So what people are missing is personal, and everybody out there kind of has that feeling of what they're missing. They have that feeling of, oh, I want to do this thing, but I've never done it, or I don't know how to do it, or I want to do it, but I'm scared. And that's not a good feeling to go to your grave with.
Is this a young person's hobby? I mean, are there people doing this up into their 60s and 70s?
So I will answer that two ways, which is a lot of the stuff I do in New York, whether it's, you know, climbing stuff or running around the subway or whatever, any New York City teenager worth their salt is done. You know, New York teenagers like to see the city and get into stuff because that's what you do when you're a teenager. There's another guy who ran around the city a lot as a teenager who has a great photo book, actually, that's out now called I Don't Warna, W-A-R-N-A, Grow Up, that I got and really enjoyed. So I would say it's definitely a young person's thing like that. That being said, my friend Nell, Danielle, is in her mid-50s and does the same stuff I do. So it all depends on who you are. I would say, you know, it's certainly the kind of thing that is mainly a young person sport, and I am old for this thing, you know. But I certainly encourage you, no matter who you are, if you're curious about it, to get into it, you know, in whatever way you're comfortable with.
Moses Gates is an urban planner, licensed New York City tour guide, and visiting assistant professor of demography at Pratt Institute. His new memoir is called Hidden Cities, Travels to the Secret Corners of the World's Great Metropolises. Moses, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me on. I had a great time.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Knecht answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org or connect with me at Chris Boyd Think on Twitter. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.